ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Fake news. It's a label tossed about on a daily basis. Fake news can be used as a way of questioning legitimate reporting when the facts don't align with someone's political position. President Trump does so regularly. Or it can describe the disinformation campaign that some countries, like Russia, are engaged in to undermine our electoral process. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to put a spotlight on fake news, not just here in America, but in countries around the world. Joining us in the studio is Maria Haig. Maria is an associate professor in UWM's School of Information Studies. She is originally from Ukraine, where the fake news phenomenon has been underway for years. Maria has been working with a team of Ukrainian journalists to debunk what she says has been an avalanche of fake news coming out of Russia. Maria, great to have you on today's program. And it is truly a phenomenon that has really swept the world in these last several years, the whole notion of people questioning whether what we hear or described as news is in fact for real.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And I, as you mentioned in your opening, I do, my research is mainly focusing on Ukraine, and that's because the phenomenon and the what we now call hybrid war and the total information disinformation domination from Russian Federation happened much earlier in Ukraine, from 2013 and then 2014 and on, and it continues now. So they kind of had more time to respond to this and also develop methods how to resist and what do you do about all this information and fake news. I also, the definition of fake news, as you mentioned, could be different. And I believe that we came up in our research, we came up with a very specific definition that focuses on mainly not on the intent on the producer of the fake news, but actually on the process, how those fake news is done. But and that was also became obvious how you resist this and how you fight this disinformation and fake news as such.
We have a lot of trust in our media in this country historically. There's been a lot of confidence that the public historically has placed in the major news networks, news organizations like NPR, which is, of course, so critical to the programming here at WUWM. In your experiences from the Ukraine, did they also have a history of solid news organizations like we have benefited from here in this country for decades?
Well, not exactly, because Ukraine was part, for the longest time, was part of the Soviet Union. It did celebrate, though, the 30th anniversary of independence from the Soviet Union. And the path to this independence after the collapse was very uneven. And in terms of the media, it's very different landscape. But it's also very different from Russia, and that's why I think what we're seeing, it's uneven development, but it's different what was happening in Russia. Because in Ukraine, the media is still mainly owned by oligarchs. So it's the one person who would be in charge. But the oligarchs, they're split in their views. And this is how Ukraine itself is very split, because there is East and West, and East is traditionally, historically, kind of more aligned with Russia. And that's why happening now that it is an open war in the eastern part of Ukraine, Donbas, that the people allowed themselves to be become those victims of disinformation, and that's why it's now a real war. But on the West, it's different. The West is always was more aligned to the West and European Union, and kind of looking forward for joining European Union. So how the population is split, this is how the media landscape was split too. And so there was pretty evenly split. There was the three oligarchs, very pro-Russian, and then three channels, main channels, split very pro-Western. But on the positive from that was that actually people would get the range of views and representations. But it's also the complexities there, because it's usually, if it's owned by oligarch, it's also the media does reflect, and the channel will reflect the interest and the business interests of the owner. So in that sense, it's very different. And that's why it's still this, it continues now. I would say Ukraine as a population, they evolved too and educated themselves, and the media, the journalists are using different methods. But they are, their kind of landscape, I would say, is very complicated, because they do, on top of just the outlandish and what seem to be amateurish information, that it, disinformation that is coming, and kind of trying to debunk those stories. But it's also, on top of it, the complexity with those business interests from the channels that are broadcasting it. So that was, that's different.
And that's a really, really valuable lesson, I think, for us here in the United States, where it really is only the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years, that fake news seems to be dominating our conversations. Today, after years and years of this introduction of fake news, attempts by Russia to manipulate or to manage the editorial agendas by virtue of the disinformation that they distribute, does the general public, the Ukrainian citizen on the street, do they get it? Do they appreciate the fact on both sides that there are efforts to manipulate them?
I would say they're definitely more aware with what I see just from my individual personal experience than in the United States, I would say. But there are still ways to go. And that's why initially, if the journalists were focusing on debunking and fact-checking, and that was, it's a very tedious work. But now they're more focusing, and it's really thriving business of information literacy and media literacy. Courses, programs, libraries are playing very important role in that. So they are shifting their focus. And actually the government itself also instituted this enormous reform of education, because also what the solution and what was obvious became obvious, that you can't, once adults, it's kind of telling them, once adults have their views and their beliefs, it's really hard, much more hard to convince the adult to do the to change their views. So that's why they are now starting just these methods of and ideas of critical thinking and not believing everything you read. And this is what, to be honest, information literacy, this is what librarians were saying for years and years, that you should not believe what you read. You do need to check, you need to go to the sources, you need to assess, evaluate the sources that you're using. So, but now in Ukraine in particular, the focus, it is, and it's built in this reform, that it's starting from elementary school, from really up to the college. Because we also know this, that it's in the United States, what the Stanford studies, and I mean, there are now many studies are showing that even these digital natives who grew up on just online, they, shockingly, they take this all at face value, whatever they get their news from Facebook.
If it's on Twitter, it must be true, because it's on a legitimate media platform.
It is changing, because I am kind of just looking, and I know I do, for the United States, I do have a small sample, but I do, because, and I'm teaching databases, so it's still the databases. We do look about the importance of technology, and then also this whole tracking business and how that works. So I do talk to students and asking them how they now, where they take the information. And I would say over this 3 years, it is changing. And it's the,
So you think students today
students
are becoming
are
more critical?
More critical. But it's also more careful and aware. So I think the message is getting through, at least for UWM students, at least what I am. Because I was very pleasantly surprised that this is, that people, that students don't believe and become a more question more what they see on Facebook and or what they see on Twitter. So I think it is kind of working, even that maybe there are no this unified program and coming major reform in education. Because I do think that those questions should be brought in from elementary school, from the kids at the age of 6, 7. They should know this.
And so I have to ask, if the government of Ukraine has decreed that the schools are going to require that there be critical thinking skills taught, that from an early age, young people will be taught to question information coming in. That's a very powerful movement or decision by the government. Come here to America, where you see this enormous political divide, where you've got the left and you've got the right and very, very little in between. Do you see it likely that we would adopt systematically the same sort of critical thinking processes that are required in schools in the Ukraine? Or is our divide deeper or greater than what you saw in Ukraine?
See, I would say in the United States, obviously, with the current administration, I don't see it happening as of now. But on the other hand, what we also see, and I think that's kind of also this American spirit, the grassroots efforts are very powerful. And this is what because I talked to multiple Ukrainian journalists and organizations, they do learn from Americans, because they do this individual, and it's happening in libraries, it's happening in kind of individual news organizations. They have the methods, and they are pushing the literacy programs forward.
And so this is people on both sides, you're saying, even those who might politically lean more towards the east, towards Russia, they're open to the idea of these critical thinking skills being taught?
Yes, but also what I'm saying in the United States, it's kind of technically this happening already. Our higher education, college education, always promoted critical thinking. But obviously, how effective it is?
So you think the environment here in the U.S. might make that even, we might be even more receptive to that?
We should be more receptive to that. But it's also, what I'm also saying, that it's still, even that there is no systematic effort coming from the government, I do think that there are just these grassroots individual efforts happening everywhere. And it does seem to me much more organized in Ukraine. But it's also, Ukraine on one hand, it's a smaller country. On the other hand, they also in much dire position, because they are really on the front line of this West, and it's literally a war. And it's, you go there because we went last year, the war in, and I go to Kiev, to the capital, so I didn't go to the East, but the war is there. They now change the narratives and not to forget that it's, so the people who are dead are still, the pictures are there. So it's kind of, the presence is very dominating. So that's what I'm saying. In Ukraine, it's also a different situation, that people are just on the streets. You can't forget. But it's also, the government did this. They, even if before 2014, 2015, the Russian channels were as ubiquitous as Ukrainian, as what I was mentioning, those oligarchs owned, there was also the whole stream of Russian channels. So actually, that's the Ukrainian government exercised censorship, and they did ban, which is kind of questionable in terms of the freedom of speech, but it was a censorship. But the position is that it's the war, they are in war, and that's why they did ban. So now they're very sensitive about, on the government level and the broadcast level and in publishing, whether there is anything Russian propaganda. But because there's so much kind of Ukrainian coming, that it's on the surface, it's a Ukrainian, but it's really kind of Russian agents. And because it's really complicated story there, because they really, I mean, the countries, they were part of the same country until fairly recently, but the businesses are very embedded. So it's really hard in terms of media, it's still hard to do this. But I just want quickly also to mention that this the programs that it's, and it's also interesting that it's actually coming the best and the most effective and the broadest, it's the IREX, the programs, which is International Research and Exchange, which is the program that American-based, they are affiliated. They're not officially part of the State Department, but they are American-based. So it's actually American taxpayers are funding this. And they are extremely good. I mean, they're in Ukraine for a long time. And they are in Russia too, and they are helping with these democratic processes. They were focusing on libraries for the longest time, and now they're focusing on this information and media literacy. So it is interesting that they are very organized, and they are making enormous impact because they are the ones who convinced the government to do this. So see, Americans are actually there. But
there's great irony here. Realize that.
I know, and they're doing only pilot programs in the United States.
Yes.
Which I think they really should be in Wisconsin. They should be everywhere. I think they are just pilot programs.
And
in
it's
Arizona.
Regardless of your political affiliation.
Exactly.
The bottom line is: shouldn't we all be working with the same set of facts
exactly.
in order to make the best decisions?
And this is what they're also saying. They're not trying to. The idea is not to convince you to believe into something else, but it's just how you approach the information that you see. And they do this for senior citizens. They do this for. So they do have the whole set of programs, IREX, and in Ukraine for the regular citizens.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujak. In the studio with us today is Maria Haig. Maria is an associate professor at UWM School of Information Studies and has been focusing much of her research on examining the phenomenon of fake news, not just here in the U.S., but as we've heard in the first part of the program, something that is ubiquitous around the world. Maria is from the Ukraine, and as we've heard her describe, for many, many years now, they've been dealing with Russia's attempts to tilt the balance of the public opinion by virtue of inserting fake or false information into the agenda of the Ukrainian people. Maria, let's broaden our conversation. We've been talking about the U.S. and Ukraine, but you have been working with colleagues in other parts of the world who have been looking at the fake news phenomenon in other countries.
We just, back at home, doing a pilot study and preparing another article with Dr. Wonchan Choi. He's an assistant professor who just joined School of Information Studies last year. And because he's Korean and reads Korean and speaks Korean, and because in South Korea, and they had very tumultuous elections and the processes, and they had it's different, the whole environment and ecology of news is different, yet you can see similarities too. So that's why what we did, what we identified and as our method approaching this disinformation and fake news phenomenon, not from the point of view kind of the origin, because very many researchers just focus on what was the intent of the creator of the fake news. Was it just to mislead? Was it to, it's a humor? Is the, so there are many, just there is a spectrum of malicious to just to humorous. What we're focusing is what was the process of creating. And that's why we're also looking at, we're studying and sort of we did for our study, we looked at the fact-checking organizations in South Korea and did in Ukraine and the United States, and we identified kind of the methods they used for debunking. So this, we're now a bit digressing because the fact-checking, it's this whole other area of fighting fake news, and that was the initial, because that's kind of an initial impulse when you see the something false. What the journalists try to do is to prove that it's false. But it's also Ukrainians realized this sooner than the United States, but the United States now realizing too and admitting this, that there are two different audiences. The audience who would do the click and believe those disinformation, who would just click on those sensational headlines,
clickbait. Yes.
And the ones who are actually the audience who would take time and read this detailed debunking of why it wasn't true, they don't overlap really. And that's why fact-checking is not what's study over and over actually showing, that it's not that effective because it's not reaching the same audience. So what we are trying, what we are looking at is how the fake news, not the intent, but the process it was created, and what were the methods, how to debunk it, and to see the similarities between different countries, and also kind of how effective it is. So that's why we're comparing United States and South Korea, and then Ukraine. So by the methods of fighting this information, how journalists.
So here in the U.S. right now, there's a huge debate over whether or not the organizations like Google, which runs YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, should those companies be held accountable? And should we put the greatest emphasis on having them monitor and self-correct if there's fake news? Do you think that's the way to go? Or do you think we should put more energy into teaching critical thinking skills, knowing that that disinformation is going to inevitably get out into the environment?
So see, I think it is a difficult question to answer, particularly in the United States, the environment and with the free speech. And the United States is very unique in that with the First Amendment is
sacrosanct. Absolutely.
It's very unique for the United States. It's just nowhere else. That's why in European countries, the governments, it's much easier for them to step in and just ban it because they don't have it. If they can ban hate speech, they can criminalize it much, much easier than they can do it in the United States. So that's why I don't see this solution of just censoring and the censorship will not work, I believe, because then it affects so many other things. But I think to me, it's also, I do believe that the only way is just educating the population. But then I guess that's also, who knows? I mean, they still make decisions. It's a very complicated questions. And it's true, as we were discussing in our discussions, that it's with my colleagues, that it's when people make good decisions that you think are right, then you think, oh, media literacy, information literacy is working. But when they still make stupid decisions and choices, then you think it's not working. Humans are still humans.
Yeah, and one of the great challenges is people who often are the targets of that disinformation are spending much, if not all of their time, on media platforms that are likely to encourage or propagate that disinformation, or at least allow it more than other organizations. And if that's the only house that they're living in, it's very hard for them to go ahead and get that self-correction or develop self-correction tools because of the literacy programs that you say are available.
I think it's more, you know, there's additional dimension to this. As you know, there are lots of families split, and what's in a sense in their political views, and it's in the United States, is the same. What the studies showed in the United States, they're actually senior citizens who are the ones most mainly sharing those fake, outrageous, completely bogus stories versus young people. And then it's also that, so it was age, this age difference, and then there will be this divide within the family. I know with me personally too, since I do have relatives in the East, but even in Kiev, but the relatives who are coming from the East, they're just watching this one channel and believe it. And then there is no way, how can you tell them that, or just besides asking, just change the channel and watch something else. And that's so it was the split. I just know in my own family, there's a split. And it's really, it's so surprising because we'd be smart people. And I know that they thought differently, and now they just opened themselves to believing. For instance, I mean, just this amazing, I mean, just these stories of crucified children in front of that Ukrainian army suddenly comes to their city and would crucify a child in front of their mother, and then the mother is dragged on the behind the tank until she's dead. Apparently, that was the one of the episodes of the Games of Thrones, that it's whoever, I mean, we know that the story came from the research agency, this IRA, this Russian agency, but people do believe it, even that there's absolutely no evidence that it happened. But it's also this whole fact, why they would suddenly, why do you suddenly people start believing that the army, Ukrainian army, that those people who were on your side, why suddenly they will be against you? And how, and I kind of saw this, because this is how my family believes. And somehow they still believe that it's, so they still live in the east, in this Luhansk area, so this republics. And then, you know, they don't believe that, they believe that the current leader is corrupt, but the next leader will come and will not be corrupt. So it's kind of this, how do you change that? But it's, I think that's why you think that this is too late. You need people from earlier age.
So, and perhaps the part of the answer is to make sure that, well, you may not be able to change opinions of folks who are older and set in their ways. I'll use that expression. The greatest hope might be with young people who still are at the age where you naturally challenge everything, right?
That's true. This is what I am. That's what I'm. Yeah. And then they're telling me that it's not good for their mental health, because this is what they, when they challenge me, and then I challenge them, and so that's the.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I do believe.
I don't know if to be encouraged on the one hand, knowing that there are genuine efforts to promote critical thinking and literacy, or knowing that in at least the Ukraine's case, you've been at this war against a propaganda war for many more years than the U.S., and it still has a long way to go.
No, you can't win it, to be honest.
So constant vigilance.
It's the vigilance, but it's a long process. And it's kind of new generation. You need, this is what everybody hope, that the new generation will be. Who knows how it will be? Because I just want, because now Ukraine just had an election and they elected the populist. To be honest, they elected a guy who played a president on television for 10 years.
Yes.
And they think, it's Trump, yeah. Ukrainian Trump. Uh-huh. So far he's saying everything the West wants to hear and the people want to hear, but he's in power just for the last 2 months. So we'll see how it is. But he's... They did elect a populist. After all this, somehow they want to believe in this dreamland.
The playbook got handed around.
But he is on the bicycle. He played always very progressive president.
Yeah, good thing this is. There's a place where NPR exists, right? And WUWM, where hopefully we see the promotion of pure factual information. Maria, thank you so much. Maria Haig, Associate Professor at the School of Information Studies at UWM, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Keep listening. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.